The Legal Sunday, The Constitutional Aspect of the Question, Chapter 2. Objections to the secular grounds on which Sunday laws have been sustained, the ground that they are necessary and proper for the physical benefit of others than the compulsory idler. We now pass to the consideration of the second class of cases sustaining Sunday laws, namely those which hold them constitutional in America on secular grounds or for reasons disconnected with religion. While some of the later cases cling desperately to the religious view of the statutes, the proportion of such cases diminishes as we come down the corridors of time. The evidence is plain that an uneasy consciousness that Sunday laws will have to be defended on some other than religious grounds, if they are to be defended at all, is penetrating the brownest tainted bench of these United States more and more deeply every year. And hence the invention of those arguments we are next to examine, which make up what is here called the secular view of Sunday laws. It has been shown that the religious views of these statutes are altogether unsatisfactory, and that no matter how the arguments based upon this view may be turned and twisted, they always end in an utterly indefensible conclusion. What is here called the secular view will be found equally unsound in its logic. But though the religious view is as unsound in its logic as the secular view, it has this great advantage over the latter. It is intellectually honest, in so far at least, that it starts out frankly and candidly by recognizing our Sunday laws as just what all men know them to be, religious dogmas incorporated into American statutes. Whereas the secular view starts with utter dishonesty, under a pretense as false as it is audacious, and, being illogical even on its own false basis, is therefore rotten from end to end. The secular view, like the religious view of Sunday laws, is twofold. Some cases holding that Sunday idleness is made compulsory because it is of physical benefit to the reluctant idler. Others, that it is required for the sake of the community, without reference to this point, the good of the body politic, and not the advantage to the individual bodies of the citizens, being the real object aimed at. But the intellectual dishonesty of either assumption is evident. Everybody knows, as a matter of fact, that Sunday laws have never been passed or enforced with the slightest reference to the sanitary or social aspects of compulsory idleness. We may make all the allowances we please for the zeitgeist and the human nature of which judges are made, and still we must credit their intelligence at the expense of their sincerity when we find them ignoring such plain propositions as these. Yet they have boldly ignored them in order to set up the false pretense that these laws are passed for the secular advantage of the community at large, and the equally false pretense that they are passed for the secular benefit of the reluctant idler. Let us consider these false pretenses in the order just given. We are told that the stability of government, the welfare of the subject, and the interests of society have made it necessary that the day of rest observed by the nation should be uniform, and that its observance should be to some extent compulsory. 1 Lindenmuller's case, 548. Also, that all agree that to the well-being of society, periods of rest are absolutely necessary. To be productive of the required advantage, these periods must recur at stated intervals, so that the mass of which the community is composed may enjoy a respite from labor at the same time. They may be established by common consent, or, as is conceded, the legislative power of the state may interfere to enforce the time of their stated return and enforce obedience to the direction. 1 ID 568. And again, if rest is to be enjoined as a matter of public policy at stated intervals, it is obvious that public convenience would be much promoted by the community generally resting on the same day, for otherwise each individual would be much annoyed and hindered in finding that those with whom he had business to transact were resting on the day on which he was working. Sunday is selected as the day of rest because, if any other day had been named, it would have imposed unnecessarily onerous obligations on the community, inasmuch as many of them would have rested on Sunday as a religious duty. 2B and O's case, Virginia, 362. Now, that like breeds like is true of nothing more than of absurdities. Something has been said already concerning this much-abused word, rest. which is bandied about so recklessly in the discussion of Sunday laws. Let us observe that the absurdity of assuming that you can compel a man to rest against his will by compelling him to close his place of business is here coupled with the absurdity that the legislature may indirectly compel him to keep his place of business open against his will in order that another man may be saved from annoyances and hindrances. Suppose I have a note to collect at the bank and am annoyed and hindered to find that my Hebrew banker is resting because it is Saturday. Suppose I have a bill to collect against a Christian and am annoyed and hindered to find that he is resting because his mother has just died. The writer has himself been more than once seriously annoyed as well as hindered by the discovery that others were resting while he was working in consequence of the early closing movement, which has lately shown the characteristics of an epidemic in some localities. And many an industrious man is annoyed and hindered likewise because others persist in resting late in bed while he is up and about betimes. But whence does an American legislature get its right to prevent such annoyances as these, either directly or indirectly? There can be but one answer. Nowhere, under any authority whatever, either expressed or implied. There is a real annoyance and hindrance of some by others in connection with Sunday business, but these are not caused by the discovery that others are resting while the discoverers are working, but by the knowledge that the industrious desire to work at a time which the lazy prefer to devote to idling. The only point that needs insistence here is that the annoyance or hindrance caused to A by B's idling, when A feels like working, is one with which, in a free government, the legislature has no concern whatever. Accordingly, if we concede that it is necessary, or even so much as advisable, to make idleness on one day compulsory, all the demands of the case would still be met by requiring this observance of everybody once a week and naming no particular time for it. The public convenience might then be safely left to dictate whatever degree of uniformity was best in the selection of the time of idling. And this evident truth suggests a reference to the exemption from the requirement of Sunday idleness, which is accorded in many states to those who conscientiously or religiously observe some other day, an exemption which would have been noticed under the religious cases, but for its utility just here. Of course, the acceptance of a conscientious or religious observance of any other day as a substitute or blood offering in lieu of Sunday idleness is an all-sufficient admission that the idleness is required as a religious duty of the idler, and is a frank avowal that the Sunday law which accords such an exemption embodies a religious dogma and represents a union of church and state. But, apart altogether from this consideration, the exemption also pricks the bubble of the necessity, or even expediency, of one uniform time of idleness by law established. So that even if the annoyance and hindrance of leaving everyone to be idle just when he pleases would justify legislative interference, provided these were of a sufficiently serious character, yet the very provisions of many Sunday laws show that, in fact, this annoyance and this hindrance are merely part of the petty troubles of life which are beyond the cognizance of law, if for no other reason, upon the principle de minimis non curat lex. The annoyance and hindrance caused to a would-be worker by the discovery that others are resting when he wants them to work, with him, is not sufficient reason for the legislature's making idleness compulsory on all during a certain period. There is more plausibility about the suggestion that the disturbance of the resters by the would-be workers insisting on doing business with them is a legitimate subject of prevention by statute, from a civil standpoint. It is correct to say, in the language of a West Virginia case, 1B and O's case, Virginia 362, that a citizen's rest should not be disturbed by others, and that such disturbance may be punished by law. Under the police power, the state notices that the rest of its citizens is taken at night, and therefore certain things may well be a nuisance at night, which are not so in the daytime.
But what kind of rest is it which the law undertakes to protect? Plainly, the physical rest, the rest of the body alone. Now, it is palpably absurd to maintain that any conditions are necessary for this rest on one day, which are not necessary every day. Some men slumber on Sunday afternoons only. Others find it expedient to repose a while every afternoon. If the first has a right to insist on special conditions being provided by law for his weekly day rest, it follows that the second has a right to the same conditions for his daily indulgence. And the business of the community cannot go on till everybody announces that his rest is finished. From such nonsense, the law rescues itself by saying to every man, "If you need more physical rest than you get where you are, go to some other place. The occupation of your neighbor will not be interrupted in order that you may enjoy your extra repose." But it is easy enough to show that with the disturbance of one man's physical rest by another, Sunday laws have nothing whatever to do. We are told, "While I am resting on the Sabbath in obedience to law, it is right and reasonable that my rest should not be disturbed by others." Such a disturbance by others of my rest is in its nature a nuisance, and Sabbath breaking has been frequently classed with nuisances and punished as such. That these are the objects of our statutes are, to my mind, clearly shown by the wording. 1 B&O's case, Virginia, 362. It is not true, as affirmed in this extract, that Sabbath breaking has been frequently classed with nuisances and punished as such. Offenses against Sunday laws have never, either here or in England, been seriously classed with nuisances, and no instances can be produced of their punishment as such by any court of last resort. And for a very good and all-sufficient reason. It was well said in Tennessee, "It would be a strained and far-fetched construction to hold that violations of the Sabbath per se would constitute a nuisance." 2. Link's case, 444. It would indeed. It would be a construction so absurd, so flatly contradictory to the settled principles of law, that no judge will ever dare to make it formally, however much the word may be carelessly employed in the obiter of Sunday law opinions. The erroneous statement just quoted is due to a mental confusion too common among the laity, but fortunately more common among them than with our judges. A man may be punished for a nuisance committed on Sunday, but then he is punished for committing the nuisance and not for Sabbath breaking. And, in considering what constitutes a nuisance, American law makes no distinction between Sunday and any other day. So a man may be punished for committing a breach of the peace on Sunday, but this is not Sabbath breaking. And, as our courts have no means of distinguishing between the disturbance of a religious meeting and the disturbance of any other kind of meeting, just so they are absolutely without any data for discriminating between a breach of the peace on Sunday and a like breach on any other day. Nuisances, then, and breaches of the peace are punished under the common law or special statutes without any reference whatever to Sabbath breaking, an altogether distinct thing, and a special and peculiar crime created by the Brownist Sunday laws. They are punished whether committed on Sunday or any other day in any civilized country, though it be one wherein there is not, and never was, a Brownist Sunday law. They were punished in England before the first Brownist Sunday law was enacted by Parliament. They would continue to be punished in the United States, though every copy after that first Brownist Sunday law was repeated. But nuisances and breaches of the peace are things understood of all men and apprehended through the physical senses, and their definition in the law is the same for all. We have seen that the only nuisance done the Brownist by his knowledge of the Sunday work, which he neither sees nor hears, is peculiar to himself and beyond the law's province. And the only disturbance of his rest and the only breach of his peace lie in this same knowledge and are also without the pale of law. The following extract will assist us to apprehend the exact nature of the rest which Sunday laws are designed to protect against disturbance. By the common law of the Commonwealth, every citizen is entitled to enjoy the first day of the week in undisturbed quiet and repose, that he may exercise his natural and indefeasible right to worship Almighty God according to the dictates of his own conscience, and whatever actual noise or disorder hinders seriously or destroys altogether this inalienable right, is and always has been a breach of the peace. 1 Jandell's case, 509. Now the contradiction of this is apparent, as man is certainly not enjoying undisturbed quiet and repose, who is exercising his right to worship Almighty God. We here get on entirely new ground. There is no longer a question of disturbing physical rest, in other words, of disturbing rest in the only real, practical sense of the word, so far as the law is concerned. The brownest observer of Sunday has voluntarily abandoned his rest. He has not waited to be disturbed at it. He has deliberately gone to work and disturbed himself. He is occupied on Sunday, as he is occupied on weekdays, only after a different fashion, about a different business. We have seen that the Seventh-day Adventists rightly maintain that for Christians to utilize the Sabbath for purposes of physical rest is quite as much a desecration of it as for them to spend the day in physical labor. The only point to be repeated just here is that, as a matter of fact, the conscientious Brownist does not spend his Sunday in physical rest at all, and that therefore, whatever else he may be disturbed in, it is not in physical rest.